Yesterday, we heard lots about education and current education and what wasn't working. And we heard about lots of great things, lots of possibilities. And today, I'm going to talk about what I call educational activism and how Superman would use social media tools. And I got this idea from a movie, a very popular movie that was out this past year that created a lot of conversation about schools and what was working and what wasn't working. How many of you seen that movie, Waiting for Superman? How many of you saw it and got a little angry? Yeah. Well, I think most people did. It didn't matter if you were a teacher and saw it, or you were a parent and saw it, or you were a school administrator, or you were a taxpayer, because it really painted a pretty sad picture of education. I'm very happy to be here at the World Future 2011 in Vancouver. And I represent Global SchoolNet. It's a nonprofit, 501c3, that we founded back in the early 80s in California. I'm very excited to have a collaborative team with me, Mr. Isma Hakila from TE Wealth in Toronto. And you will get to meet some real practitioners, some real teachers. Today you'll get to meet Pauline Roberts and Rick Joseph. And tomorrow, if you come to the session tomorrow, you'll also get to meet Phil, who's from the Vancouver area. We really wanted to have young bodies in the audience. Not that you're young and have young bodies, but 6 years ago, we were connected, Global SchoolNet was connected with the World Future Society for the purpose of helping to get more youth involved in thinking about the future and these deep thoughts that we're sharing together. And we really tried to have some young people here this year. We've been very successful in doing it in the past, and we just, the logistics didn't work out, and we weren't able to. But we do have some videos, so where you will not be able to actually interact with them live, there are social media tools that you'll be able to carry on the conversation if you choose to do so. And speaking of conversation, those of you that are connected and are interactive, please join the conversation. You can go to twitter.com/globalschoolnet. And as we're talking, you can add your comments, you can add ideas, you can ask questions, and hopefully this really will be a collective wisdom of crowds and we'll be able to share our knowledge. So I want to give you a little bit of my background. That's 1984. That's me sitting at my Apple IIe computer in the back of my middle school classroom. I was a middle school teacher for 14 years. And I was teaching very low-achieving students, and I was challenged to improve their test scores. And quite by accident, I discovered that when I connected my students with other students and had them write for other students, it was very motivating to them. And we were doing it the old-fashioned way, pen and pencil. Around that time, email became available. And we began using email and getting involved in the writing project to teach student writing skills. 8 years later, we got a grant from the National Science Foundation to create the first educational website online called the Global Schoolhouse. It was a $2 million grant, and the idea was to connect schools so that students could learn with one another and from one another. And it was actually before the web, so we used internet-based video conferencing, a program called CUCME that came out of Cornell University. And I can tell you that even though 10 years before that, my students had been doing collaborative activities, it wasn't until people could see them in front of that video camera in the herky-jerky motion that it was back in those days that they got the aha, oh yes, this is what kids can actually do. So then the web became available. Then we realized the more we can create artifacts of what the students are learning and put them up on the web, that will accelerate the whole industry. So every time we did a project, we would make sure that we put that project online and also created the reflective piece, the piece that told how we did it, how we organized it, what were the challenges, so that if others wanted to follow that formula, they could. And that became very successful. So here we are, 2011. We've done over 3,000 projects. We're in 194 countries, and we have 100,000 online educators that are involved in these projects. Now, that sounds pretty big. How many of you have never heard of us? Probably most. And that's because we're not a commercial organization, so it's all done through word of mouth, professional societies, and we actually have a huge following, but we don't do sort of the mainstream print advertising, that kind of a thing. So what is our focus? Where do we come from? We focus on standards-based collaborative activities that connect U.S. students to students worldwide to explore community, cultural, scientific issues. Our emphasis is on using the constructivist learning model. The constructivist learning model says that people learn best when they're involved in the construction of their own knowledge, where they create some sort of an artifact or evidence of what they've learned, where they can share that evidence with their peers, and that they can get feedback. So that is the complete cycle. So what's an artifact? It can be a report, it can be a website, it can be a podcast, it can be a video, it can be it can be any of these things. But it's something that captures the learning that can be observed and that they get the feedback. So in 1996, Cisco and MCI came to us and said, these again, the early days of the web, we want you to design a collaborative project that will take advantage of this new internet technology. And we really want the communities to know about what's happening in the schools. So at that time, we thought about it and we said, there's really a lot of cool things that are happening inside schools, but what do you mostly hear about in the newspaper? You mostly hear about the negative things. So we said, okay, so we want to change that. The next thing is, we also noticed that we had already been doing these collaborative projects through email and some through the web. We also noticed that our students didn't know very much about their own community. They certainly didn't know about the world, but it was interesting. They didn't know who their own leaders were, what businesses were in their community, what history, and so on. So we designed this project, CyberFair, which is based on the concept of the World's Fair. Now, in the World's Fair, anybody had ever been to a World's Fair? All right, a lot in this audience. Well, you go and you see, you learn about other countries and their products and their businesses and their culture, and it's very exciting. So you go to their exhibits. CyberFair is virtual exhibits that are created by students. We looked at the requirements for all of the states in the United States, and we talked to several countries that were going to do this with us, and we came up with common categories like leadership, history, environment, art, culture, special populations. And we created different curriculum units. So if you go to the website, and we don't have time to do that now, you'll see there are 8 different curriculum units that have discussion questions, learning objectives, starter activities, and a library of projects that go back to 1996. Some of those are still active, how the web changes and link changes, but all of the reflective pieces, the project narratives are there. So you can see that there are projects that cover all of those different topics. And what's very exciting is very early on we began to develop national partners. So we have affiliates in Taiwan, Russia, Romania, Poland, Uzbekistan, Macedonia, many, many countries have decided that they want their students to be not necessarily globally competitive, but globally aware. So when I was thinking about doing this talk, and by the way, I just 2 days before this coming here, was in Philadelphia for the International Society for Technology and Education, which is a huge education conference, 20,000 teachers. And I was basically talking about the same thing. And I talked each year and I said, well, what can I say a little bit different this year? My message has been pretty consistent over the last two decades, and I feel like the world is finally starting to catch up. But I thought about, what has put me in the position that I am, that I feel so passionate about getting schools involved in this thing. And I picked out certain things, certain trends that I could see, and books that were written about these trends. Well, everybody has heard of The World is Flat. That's been around for a long time. Did you know that there is a World is Flat 3.0? And if you like The World is Flat, then I recommend definitely reading and finding out that The World is Flat 3.0, because it really goes into the next layer of connectedness and globalization and how we're all connected. And whatever happens health-wise, environment-wise, peace and security-wise in this part of the world is going to be affecting us in the other part of the world. The wisdom of crowds, very important. It's been said that no longer can we learn as an individual everything that we need to know. We need to surround ourselves with a crowd of people that will filter that information and help us get to the information that we need when we need it. So it's also very interesting, though, because it's many versus few. So it can get too noisy. So part of it is finding the right crowd, and the second part of it is making sure that it's not too noisy once you get in that crowd, because crowds can be very noisy. Waiting for Superman. We talked about the movie. Did you know there's an app for that? You can actually download an app to your smartphone or to your iPad, and it's interactive, and you can join the conversation. All of the topics that they talked about, good teachers, class size, too much homework, all of these different things, you can go into the app and you can form little communities and discuss this. And again, you can, by doing so, you move the industry forward. Race to Nowhere. Okay, the second movie I saw this year that was very, very, had a great impact on me. Anybody see Race to Nowhere? Very few of you. If you're interested in education at all, if you're a practitioner, by the way, how many of you are practitioners? You're actually in a classroom or working with teachers and preparing teachers? Okay, a lot. Okay, how many of you are policymakers? Anybody here? Policymakers, administrators? Great. All of you need to see Race for Nowhere. I think you can download it from the internet. It's all about achievement, student achievement, but at what cost? And the main focus is that schools have become a place where there is no time for learning, because it's only being trained to pass the tests. So students are being given so much homework, they no longer have a balanced education. They're in school, in their seat, they're grinding through the curriculum, and then when they get home, they have hours and hours of homework. And there's a couple of scenarios in the movie that show, how stressful this is to the students, how stressful it is to the teachers and to the parents, because the students are not getting to do the things that they really need to do: explore music, explore sports, explore art, stamp collecting, even clubs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, because of the homework, the pressure of doing the homework. All right, two people yesterday talked about the brain. And how many of you have heard of the book Train Your Brain, Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, and heard the word neuroplasticity? Okay, you need to put that on the top of your list, because that really is going to be the next trend in looking at, how we can change education. For many years, they thought when your brain developed to a certain point, no longer was it like creating, more neural passageways. And over the last 5 years, they found out that's not true. Through looking at stroke victims and other kinds of brain injuries, they've learned that, in fact, your brain does recreate those neural passageways. The problem is that the brain can keep on growing and learning, but does the mind want to do it? And I can tell you a personal story. A couple of months ago, a close friend of mine had a stroke. and it was a minor stroke, but he lost some of his ability to talk and ability to walk. And at first, we were very happy that it was just a minor stroke, and we thought it was just a matter of rehabilitation. You know, how much exercise could he get? And you know, the doctor said, you know, he was going to be in good shape and he was going to, you know, come back very quickly. That was all fine, but his mind wasn't there. His attitude wasn't there. When I say his mind, he wasn't motivated. And so even though the prognosis was very good physically for him to improve, attitudinal-wise, it wasn't there. Now, I'm happy to report it's been a few months later, and through various coaching and mentoring and so on, he's getting there attitudinal-wise, and he can make a full recovery if he stays at it. But amazing things happening with the brain, and how the effect of what we're learning about the brain will affect how we can teach students. And then the final trend book that really I think we need to look at is non-biological intelligence. And, you know, Ray Kurzweil always speaks at this conference, or has many times in the past, and, you know, he talks about singularity and sort of the merging of nanobiology and robotics and so on, and how non-biological intelligence, you know, is going to surpass our own internal intelligence. So recommend, if you're not familiar with those, please take a look, and if you know of others you think that this group should hear about, please go ahead on Twitter and share that. Okay, so educational activism. What are the compelling reasons? The compelling reasons are economics. We heard yesterday it's in turmoil. Age demographics, people are living longer. Global connectedness, we already said that. Workforce development, the skills that people need once they get in the workforce, completely different than what we're preparing for them for in schools, and collaborating on our future, what's possible, preferable, and preventable. Now, when I do this conference, people always want me to talk about what are the latest, greatest tools. So here are some of the tools, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the tools, because I can tell you that I've been involved in this for 2 decades, and the tools change every 5 minutes. But my message hasn't changed. And I go back and I look at what I was saying about globally connecting people and collaborating, and that message has been the same. But these are some of the great tools. Everybody needs a photo sharing tool. Everybody needs a collaborative document sharing tool. Everybody needs, you know, some sort of video tool. Wikipedia is great, you know, getting people involved in Wikipedia and Wikibooks and so on. All right, how we connect. We connect in all these different ways. And what's interesting is I would show this slide in some of my other presentations, but it was only this year that I thought to add the last one there, F to F. And I thought, you know what? We're doing F to F right now, right? Face to face. It is very important to have that face-to-face connection. You can do all of the virtual learning, but you really need to think about a blended learning environment. Now, having said this about how we're all connected, I want to show you a short little video clip that talks about what's called the echo boomer generation.
If you've ever wondered why corporate America, Hollywood, Madison Avenue, and the media all seem to be obsessed with the youth culture, the answer is simple. The largest generation of young people since the 1960s is beginning to come of age. They're called echo boomers because they're the genetic offspring and the demographic echo of their parents, the baby boomers. Born between the early 1980s and the early 1990s, there are nearly 80 million of them. They're already having a huge impact on entire segments of the economy. And as the population ages, they'll become the next dominant generation of Americans. Who are they? What do they want? You'll be surprised. The oldest are barely out of college. The youngest, still in grade school. And whether you call them echo boomers, Generation Y, or millennials, they already make up nearly a third of the U.S. population and spend $170 billion a year of theirs and their parents' money. Almost none of it on boring things like mortgages and medication.
Have a good evening, guys.
And the world is falling all over itself trying to sell them things.
Thank you.
What brands do you guys love?
Sony, dude.
Patagonia.
Gap. Gillette.
Aveda.
I feel like I...
Only a small percentage are eligible to vote, yet they're already one of the most studied generations in history by sociologists, demographers, and by marketing consultants like Jane Buckingham of the Intelligence Group. who uses focus groups like this one to gather information for clients like NBC, Chanel, Nike, and Levi Strauss.
How much time did you guys say you spent on the internet a day?
A couple hours a day.
A couple hours. Who would say more than TV?
Oh, yeah.
Which do you like better?
Internet.
They're a reflection of the sweeping changes in American life over the past 20 years. The first to grow up with computers at home in a 500-channel TV universe. Multitaskers.
Hello.
With cell phones, music downloads, and instant messaging on the internet. Totally plugged-in citizens of a worldwide community.
Are you connected from the moment you get up?
Pretty much.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have iPods?
Yes.
Of course. They're required by law now in the subways.
They're giving them away at Duke.
Okay, totally connected citizens of a worldwide community. That's a very powerful statement. Sorry here. So again, our website, we have a lot of information on our website. And these videos, you can actually download these videos from the Global School Net YouTube site. There we go. All right. That's globalschoolnet.org. All right. So economic and age demographics. I was actually surprised that this didn't come up in yesterday's discussion. Maybe it's just everybody knows it, but I need to repeat it because it's being recorded. There will be people that are not at this session. And the old demographics formula was we learned for approximately 20 years. We went to school. And then we went to work for approximately 45 years. We labored. And if we were lucky, we retired and had, 10, 15, 20 years retirement, right? Old formula. New formula, not going to work anymore. That's not going to work. First of all, people are living to be a lot older. They say that kids that are in kindergarten today will live to be 120. The retirement age is going to be bumped up. Maybe it will never be able to retire. So who wants to work? What if the retirement age is 75 or even 80? Who wants to work until you're 80 years old and then retire? I mean, can you go surfing? Can you go skateboarding? There's a lot of things you can't do when you're 80 years old. So the formula is going to be, let's integrate that. Let's learn, work, and have fun throughout our entire lives. So let's put fun back into the schools. Let's put music and art. Let's put real projects back into the schools so that students are learning project management skills when they're young. One of the partners of Global School Net is the Project Management Institute Education Foundation. How many of you have heard of the Project Management Institute? It's a professional organization of 120,000 project managers throughout industry. And what they say is that is one of the most important skills that people need in the workforce. There isn't a career that you can have that doesn't require some project management. Let's have longer vacation times. In the U.S., 2 weeks. It's pretty awful, right? There's not enough time to regroup. You can't learn anything during your vacation. You can barely, take care of the chores that you need to do. So if we're really talking about shaking up education, let's look at the structure. Whoever said it has to happen between this hour and this hour, during these many years, and at the end, then you're in the workforce. It's not going to work that way. So if we want to get into, very high-level discussion, how can we restructure that, thinking that we're going to be learning, working, and playing through, from the time, we're old enough to go to school, whatever that is, 6 years old, until, well into your 80s or 90s. All right. Just a little background on what collaborative learning is. It's all of these things. It's collective wisdom. It's co-created content. How many of you work in geographically dispersed work environments where you have to collaborate with people that you may not see, but you're using online tools to do it? This is happening more and more. It's project management. It's virtual field trips so that maybe the students can't go to the Smithsonian and they can't go to the Tower of London and they can't go to a zoo in Australia, but through these collaborative projects, they're able to take virtual field trips and go there. It's global exhibitions and it's global competitions. And it's wikis and flexbooks. From this education conference that I went to, I can tell you that schools are deciding not to spend money on textbooks anymore, and they're going to what's called flexbooks, where these are online textbooks, and they're updated, of course, much more frequently than the old textbooks and textbook adoption could allow. And blended learning. It's not going to be all online, and it's not going to be traditional face-to-face. There's a right formula depending on what the subject is you're teaching. You know, if you're teaching calculus and you don't have a calculus teacher in your school, then maybe that part of it has to be predominantly online. But there are a lot of different learning scenarios where it's partly face-to-face, you meet a couple of times a week or once a week or a couple of times a month, and it's also online. Actually, before I go back, so it's really a combination of the content, the appropriate content, the tools, and the methodology, like I said, constructivist learning. Okay, so what if you want, if schools want to get involved in these fantastic collaborative projects, how do they do it? How do they find partners? How do they find projects? On our website, the Global SchoolNet website, we've created a clearinghouse for projects called the Projects Registry. And you can go and do a search by curriculum fit. This works? Ah, curriculum fit. By technology type. So you can do different conferences, or you can do digital portfolios, or you can do blogs. But this is actually the most important and significant piece. This is the argument for why collaborative learning will be more effective than traditional learning. And what is it, why would anybody want to take the learning experience out of a classroom and connect with others? There has to be some added value. So we did a lot of research and came up with these 17 different types of collaborations. And they're listed here, but I'm going to pull up on the next slide. I'm going to pick out a few of them. If you go online, each one of these pops up. So one example is pool data analysis, and that's where locations, groups of learners are collecting data at different sites and doing pooling their data through maybe a Google Doc and then doing a shared analysis. We did a project with Google called the Google Global Warming Project, where we had 2,000 schools submitting ideas on ways to reduce or address global warming. And then it was all entered into a spreadsheet. Then they voted on their best projects and or their best ideas. And then we picked out the top 50. And then Google took out a huge ad in USA Today and printed the recommendations from all of these 50 schools. Social action. Again, this is very important. I'm going to show you a few examples of social action projects where students get involved in these for humanitarian reasons. Information exchange, the most common. They're talking about, different zoos, different recipes, different environmental issues. For young children, travel buddies, very popular, where you take a stuffed animal, the little elephant, and he's at the conference, and you write about his experience from the elephant's perspective and what he's seeing and doing. Well, young kids can do that. There's a huge project called the Flat Stanley Project based on the Travel Buddy concept. Sequential creation is very fun and very creative. And you might be familiar, somebody writes the beginning line of a story, and then you pass it on to the next group, and they write the next chapter, and then they pass it on to the next, sometimes called a boomerang story. And then electronic publishing, very popular. We do a project called International News Day, where the students are the correspondents. We have a theme, and they write stories, they submit it, and then all their partner classes download the stories and create their own versions of newspapers. Okay, some real projects. This is a project from Indonesia, and this is actually the students' website, and I like it because the students are talking about what role they played in this project. So this student said, I translated the article and made a bibliography. Now, when you do international projects, the biggest challenge is language. There has to be a common language. So by default, right now, that language is English. So these schools that are participating from other countries, they do the project in their native language, they translate the ones that they want to share, and then they share it with the international community. But at the same time, they're, you know, both, all of the students are learning the different languages. All right, this student here, let's see, porno work, okay. This other student did research, made the article. The student on the bottom, I did the research and the video editing, and the one in the corner, I designed the web. Now, the little cartoon says, I think you'd be delightfully surprised by the quality of work on this assignment. I crowdsourced it. All right, so let me show you another little video clip here, and this is about how students feel about working in teams.
He says all the research on Echo Boomers always reflects the same thing, that they're much different than their self-absorbed, egocentric baby boomer parents.
Nothing could be more anti-boom than being a good team player, right? Fitting in, worrying less about leadership than followership. You go into a public school today, teamwork is stressed everywhere. Team teaching, team grading, collaborative sports, community service, service learning, student juries. I mean, the list goes on and on. One of the impacts that boomers had on...
Howe thinks they're more like their grandparents, the great World War II generation, more interested in building things up than tearing them down.
When you ask kids, what do you most hope to achieve there? Where they used to say, I want to be number one, I want to be the best. Increasingly, they're saying, I want to be an effective member of the team. I want to do everything that's required of me.
And you can already see some results. Violent crime among teenagers is down 60 to 70%. Tobacco and alcohol use is at an all-time low. So is teen pregnancy. 5 out of 10 Echo Boomers say they trust the government. Virtually all of them trust mom and dad.
So how many of you were surprised to hear that? I know I was when I heard it. It's not usually what you hear in the mainstream media. All right, a couple more minutes here. I just wanted to quickly take you through a couple of projects. These are all online, and you can go look at these in greater depth. This is a project that, a CyberFair project. You're going to hear more about CyberFair from our teachers that are here, about animal conservation. And I really love this project because if you go click on the links, and I won't have time to do it now, you'll see the different tools that they use. This is a screen capture. They used Twitter, they used Facebook, they used a wiki, they used a blog, all of it to create this fabulous website about animal conservation and have a worldwide community engaging in it. This is a wonderful project from San Diego. Their entire school got involved in this project on civic responsibility. There's actually 400 students at the school. 105 students, ages 5 through 18, participated. It was quite content-driven. And what they did is, if you go to their website, you can pull down the different aspects of San Diego, and depending on the age level of the students, you will see appropriate content that was created by those students. Now, this next one here. Based on the concept of CyberFair, the State Department came to us and said, we love this idea. Would you repurpose that concept for global issues? So 7 years ago, we developed something called Doors to Diplomacy. It's a competition for middle school and high school students. They work in small teams, and they create educational projects that teach others about international affairs and diplomacy. They compete for scholarships. The State Department provides a scholarship, $2,000 to each student and $1,000 to the school. And this is one of the winning projects from this year out of New Jersey. And the title theirs was Cultural Diplomacy with the Muslim World. And they used music to get their message across about how the role that music can play in connecting the East to the West. And I recommend that you, when you have a time, go look at that. Finally, These projects are extremely applicable to social issues. This is a project that came out of Chicago, Illinois. They did their project on sex trafficking, and I recommend that you go and there's a button that you'll be able to click on their reflections and how the students talk about what they learned by doing this project and being able to share this project with the rest of the world. This is a great example of how education is using Facebook. You know, you've heard of all the kind of frivolous ways to use it. Well, here, Fairfax, Virginia, congratulations to the McLean High School softball team. Watch the school scene video. Congratulations to students and who took part in the promotion ceremonies, and there's photos there. So it's a great communication tool and a community built around it. All right. Finally, I wanted to share this cartoon with you. And I think this is the way we're all feeling. So here's the little mouse. He says, I'm here to work on my resume. I will finish my resume. Ping. Oh, an email. Could it be important? Hey, it's got a YouTube link. Got to watch it. Haha, that's great. There's got to be more like it. I've never even heard of that show. I think I'll Wikipedia it. Wait, that's not the right show, but who's that girl? She's hot. Oh, wait, I'll Google her image. Ooh, well, look at these photos. I think I'll post them on Facebook. Hey, I got a friend request. Wait, I don't even know that guy. I should Google him. Whoa, he's a freak. I'll write about him on my blog. Wonder who's talking about my blog. I should Google myself. No, it's time to do my resume. Ping. Ooh, it's an email. So, again, wisdom of crowds, too much information, and how do we filter it? I thought that was just a wonderful way to show it. All right. So what I'd like to do now is I'm going to save the questions to the end because we're going to do something different with the questions. But what I'd like to do is bring up our teachers from Michigan who are going to talk about their CyberFair project. And I was very excited, even though we couldn't bring students here live, that we were able to get students involved in the World Future Society Conference by making them think about the future. And that was the theme for CyberFair this year. Our theme was to get students involved in thinking about the futures of their community. So I'd like to introduce Pauline Roberts and, Jessup.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Rick Joseph. I am a fifth and sixth grade teacher from Birmingham, Michigan, in suburban Detroit. I'm a National Board certified teacher in the United States, and I'm active with the National Writing Project as well. And I've been fortunate enough to work with Pauline Roberts here for the last 4 years, and we quickly realized when we put our heads together that we needed to make sure that our kids had a reason for coming to school every day. And we wanted to make sure that what they engaged in transcended the educational buzzwords that we heard swirling all around us, things like rigor and relevance, and really connected to them. And the notion of rigor, of course, means that what the kids are doing is challenging and stimulating and engaging. And then, of course, relevance means that it's meaningful to them and that they can connect to it in ways that they care about and that they understand. And Yvonne has just spent a tremendous amount of given us tremendous examples of how relevance matters and the ways in which kids will desperately want to learn if they have a reason to do so. So when Pauline and I took a look around us in our suburban Detroit community, we realized there was a resource that's common to all of us, which we all need throughout the world. And of course, that's water, clean water, and access to clean water. So we began there, and we took a look at a number of projects which enabled our kids to become what we call eco-warriors and activists, not only for clean water in our local watershed, but for other projects in our community which impact the environment. And it enabled the kids to become directly active in promoting the health and welfare of their local environment.
As you can see, Rick and I, hello, I'm Pauline Roberts. We were really excited by Cyber Fair because it gave our students something authentic to do and to get out into the community and to really learn about the history of where they live and what's gone on in the watershed in the past. So they studied the history of the watershed and the consequences of the actions that people took in the past. They looked at the present, and then they considered the potential future of our watershed, and they thought about the preferred future that they would like to see for their watershed, and then came up with ideas of what they could do to make the preferred future happen. It wasn't a case of them sitting down and thinking, oh, the future is grim. The future could be wonderful, but what do we have to do? What can we do to make the preferred future happen? And they designed and implemented lots of different projects that they generated together in small groups. And one of their projects was they wanted to have carbon emissions reduced in the local watershed. And this is a video that they made.
Turn the heat down while you're sleeping or away during the day, and keep temperatures moderate at all times. Replace an incandescent bulb with a CFL. Turn off electronic devices when not in use. Stop ordering those unwanted catalogs by calling to request your name to be removed from their mailing list. Properly inflate tires, because inflated tires give you good gas mileage. Wash your clothes in cold water instead of warm water to save energy. Drive left. Walk. Bike, carpool, or use public transportation to reduce your gas usage.
Hi, my name is Bob, and I approve this message. I got
the magic. So that was one way. That was one project that just those four students did to promote awareness of what you can do to make your preferred future happen.
And so essentially, when our kids got involved with the opportunity to work with cyberschools.net, they realized that they could, in fact, make a difference in what happened in the school building itself, in the community, and then across the world. So we looked at the ways in which Chinese students in mainland China were working to improve the health of the Yellow River. We looked at the ways in which students in various countries throughout Europe were improving the quality of water in their communities and the ways that they were fighting desperately to preserve and protect the quality of their water supplies. And what Pauline and I did was something that we, of course, wanted our kids to do, and that is we were a model of collaboration. So she and I worked together in ways that we had not before. I teach language arts and social studies, and Pauline teaches math and science. But we spent 8 weeks working together on this interdisciplinary unit, planning and then teaching both of us together, the two of us in the same room at the same time with all of our students. Sometimes they were in big groups, one big group of 54. Other times they broke out into smaller groups. But we also left the school building. We did something that fewer and fewer schools are able to do recently, and that is we took field trips. Not all of them, all 54 children together at the same time necessarily, but sometimes group of 10 children who would go to visit a landfill, or another small group of children who went to visit with an urban planner who works for the city of Detroit and talked about land use and the history of the way land was zoned and the way that impacts water quality in our community. We visited the world's largest green roof at the Ford Rouge plant in Dearborn, Michigan, and why that facility was designed and created the way that it was. And so kids began to see themselves as beyond individual students sitting in a desk in a classroom. They began to see themselves as agents of change in their community, in our city, and in our country and in our world, which, of course, was our intent. So they became exceptionally empowered, and empowered as eco-warriors.
I think that's it. I think you said it all.
There was one video we were going to show as well, a conversation that one of our students had with our building principal. We received a lot of support from our building principal, and those of you who are in any kind of administrative capacity realize that oftentimes the sun rises and falls with the decisions of the administrator in any given building. And we were very fortunate to have tremendous support from our building principal, Adam Hartley. And so at all levels, we had a tremendous amount of collaboration. And of course, it started with Pauline and I, but from our students to our principal to our to our parent community, we are very, very fortunate in that way. So the video you're about to see shows one of our students who is entering sixth grade. His name is Josh, and Josh is having a conversation with our principal, Adam Hartley. One of the things that Pauline and I also did is we realized there's a great spiral effect. And that when we give the kids an idea, they oftentimes run with it and take it in directions that we never could have anticipated. And they give us a lot of ideas. And we oftentimes sit back and let them go with it very much in a constructivist way, which, you know, Yvonne mentioned the way in which if we provide the right environment and if we provide the right tools and we trust the kids enough, then they, in many ways, will lead the way and they will teach us. Which is, again, another a way in which we create a collaborative community, which is very powerful for us.
Our topic was environmental awareness. We made a wiki. You can visit that wiki at riverrougewatershed.wiki.
That's Josh.
k12.mi.us. And we said, how we're being good stewards.
Very tech-savvy individual.
And helping our watershed.
Wow, so it's a worldwide competition. So
there he is.
We received the Platinum Award. Hello, BCS community. I am here with Josh Chatnick. He's a fifth grader from our Joe Works 54. And we have some exciting news to tell you. Birmingham Covington was awarded the Platinum Award at this year's Cyber Fair, and I'm here to talk to Josh about that. Josh, how are you?
Good.
Good, good. I have some questions. Is it okay if I ask you?
Yeah.
Okay, Josh, what exactly is the Cyber Fair?
Cyber Fair is a worldwide competition. There's lots of different topics you can choose, and you make a website or a wiki and to describe your topic. And our topic was environmental awareness, and we made a wiki. You can visit that wiki at riverrougewatershed.wiki.birmingham.k12.mi.us. And we said, how we're being good stewards for our environment and helping our watershed.
Wow, so it's a worldwide competition. So, explain, and I understand we received the Platinum Award, and we were, I believe, we're the only school in the United States to receive that Platinum Award.
And then there's one other in Romania and the rest are in Asia.
Across in Asia. Wow, that's awesome. Great job. So explain to us a little bit what your class did to participate in the Cyber Fair.
We made a wiki describing how we were being good stewards for our environment and how we were keeping it green. And we go to the Rouge twice a year, all the 5-6, and we test the water quality. And so we know what's in the water, and we look at the life in the water. And we test it so we know what we can do to help the water quality and make it better.
Great. What role did you play?
So we sort of all work together.
Okay.
And we all made the wiki together, and we put in information, we all put in information about it. And we, the fifth graders, we did a Siemens challenge, and we did something called the Energy Patrol, and we would go at 4:05 somebody every day in every hall. For example, maybe someone would go to the 400 hall and turn off all the dock cams and the computers and the lights and stuff so it would save energy. And the fifth graders in Gilbert's 54 did that.
Yeah, and I want to thank Josh and his classmates for doing that, because actually a couple days ago I just found out that we were in the top three schools in Birmingham Public Schools that have saved energy this year. And that we can say that that was on our students. So great job with that. Going back to the cyber fair, this sounds like a lot of science and something you did during the science class, but it's not maybe your normal science lesson.
No,
was this different from that, and how?
Yeah, it was really different because it was sort of like science and social studies mixed together, because maybe we learned about how we could help that, and that was the science-y part, and then maybe... And then we learned about the geography and stuff and all the erosion, and maybe that was the social studies part. And,
Yeah, that's great. So as a fifth grade student, I know you guys spent a lot of time. You went to the River Rouge, what was it, one time a month, I think?
No, twice a year.
Twice a year, okay. And so was this worthwhile for you? Is it something that you would want to participate again here at Covington?
Yeah, and we actually just went to the River Rouge on May 19th. So,
okay.
Yeah, I thought this was a really good experience. And
great. Now, along with anything, there's always challenges. So let's end this interview with maybe the one challenge that you had. And if you had to do it all over again, how might you be able to turn that challenge into an opportunity?
Well, like, our challenges were we had to find the right information, and we had to make sure that it was true. You couldn't go Google... Mrs. Roberts calls it GCP, Google copy-pasting, and you say, oh, click on that, oop, that looks good, copy-paste. You can't just do that. You have to go make sure it's the right information, and it's the right, and it sounds right, and it fits into the right category. And we had to make sure that it was very descriptive, and everybody knew what we were doing. And we also, we went on lots of field trips. We went on a field trip with a... There's a professor from U of M Dearborn, and he guided.
All right, I'm gonna stop it there. You can watch more of Josh on YouTube. I think he'll be having his own show pretty soon. Okay, I wanted to comment on the Cyber Fair project and the other collaborative projects that we do, and that is the difference between collaborative learning and traditional learning, and where in the past it's been learning for the test, is the difference between learning facts and creating memories. And those kids that are involved in hands-on projects are creating memories, and that is facilitating the learning and the retention aspect of it. And I like to tell this story about this research where they had two groups. One group that was learning the traditional way, and they were studying from the textbook, and they were having to pass tests. And another group that was doing project-based learning activities, learning the same content. And they, at the end of a school year, they both groups were tested. The traditional one, you know, reading chapters, writing the answers in the back, and taking the test. The other one, hands-on projects like Cyber Fair. At the end of a year, they got tested. And you know what? Their tests were about the same. So you might ask yourself, why should we do something like project-based learning, put the extra effort in, if we measure them and the test scores are going to come out the same? But then they measured them again in a year. And the kids that were involved in project-based learning had 80% retention. And the kids that were involved in learning the facts to pass a test had somewhere around 15% retention. So if we're really wanting to teach kids and give them the learning that will last them a lifetime, we have to think about these kinds of activities and not just having them take tests. The next presenter I'm going to invite up is my colleague, Ismay Kela, and he's going to talk about a topic that is critically important, which has been identified by the Partnership of 21st Century Learning, which is financial literacy. And As adults, we know how economics are affecting us, the choices that we make, the cars that we buy, the houses that we live in, the clothes that we buy, and so on. You can imagine how economics are going to affect people that are in school today when they become adults, when retirement ages change, when no longer are the things that used to be trusted places to put your money, like stocks and real estate. You know, no longer do we know what direction those things are going. So I looked at a lot of conference presentation descriptions for a lot of education conferences, and I noticed there was a real lack in this idea of financial literacy, even though it's been identified as one of the essential skills by the Partnership for 21st Century Learning. So anyway, as I was thinking about this two-day education conference or summit, I said, you know, we can talk about how education needs to be changed. So here's the challenge. I want you to think about, we've been talking about education, how it should change. Is it doing the right thing? Are we preparing our youth for the world? Are they thinking about the future? But my question to you as an individual is, what is the purpose of education? What should the main purpose of education actually be? Now, I will agree that all of these things, to some degree, might be important. But if you had to select the top most important purpose of education, what would that be? And I'm going to read these to you. Would it be workforce readiness? Or do we need to give the students the skills they will need to be successful in the workforce? Is that the most important thing? We've talked a lot about that. Is it basic literacy? Is it very important that to ensure that every student has core literacy skills, including reading, writing, and math? Should we be making them critical thinkers? Is that the most important thing? Is it more important to teach students how to be critical thinkers and problem solvers? Or is it for the greater good? Should we be preparing students to contribute to the greater good of society and benefit humanity? Or some people would say it's actually to prepare youth for their future participation in the democratic process. Now, maybe we don't think so much that way in the United States, but I can tell you in other countries, this is a very important purpose for education. Okay, let me just. Is it self-actualization? To encourage students to explore their individual potential and creativity? Or is it for moral values? Should we be teaching? Is the main purpose of education to teach students the importance of not harming others? Or is it for health and longevity? Is it prepare students to be healthy and to live as long as possible? Now, some of you have little clicker devices. I want you to pick one of those eight, those of you that have the clicker devices. No, don't pick it yet. When ISMO says it's time? But what we're going to show you is the wisdom of crowds. We're trying to use a piece of technology and demonstrate how we can learn what others are thinking, you know, collectively. And by the way, we are going to have more questions like this. If you didn't get to use the clicker this time, we're going to pass the clicker on during these other questions. So you're going to have a chance to do it. So it sounds like this is creating a little conversation, a little dialogue here. Well, you know what? I'm going to let ISMO work this. And I can tell you, write down your answer, because we might get this to work. But write down your answer as you've answered it right now. All right? Now, wait a second. All right? Now, remember when you were in elementary school? How would you have answered that question? What did you think the purpose of school was when you were in elementary school? Which one of those? Right? Okay, write down your answer, what you thought it was when you were in elementary school. What did you think the purpose of education was when you were in high school? Now, I can tell you I've done this a number of times with different groups, and the answers are all over the board. Ask kids and their parents, you're going to get completely different answers.
We've got a discussion session at the end. after I've done a wrap-up, to give you a chance to repair anything that I created. Actually, David and I would like you to think, while you're thinking about this one, what is a wise futurist? If we're thinking about the wisdom of the crowd, crowd sources, purpose, and we want to discuss that as part of the wrap-up when we get in. You've got pads of paper, you've got Twitter, everything you want to put together, but we're really interested in thinking about what is a wise futurist.
And actually that reminded me, we also have several World Future Society discussion forums where some of these things are already being discussed, so you can go to the website and add your comments to that as well.
Okay, let's just get through this one. Go ahead and vote. Anywhere between 1 to 8. There's 30 remotes. By the way, those clickers don't work on your TV or garage door, so I do need them back. Okay. There's your answers.
Okay, well, I have, obviously, this is the first time I'm seeing what your answers are because this is real time. We're doing this real time. So, looks like the top winner is self-actualization. Oh, I'm sorry. Where's critical thinker?
Called financial literacy.
Oh, critical thinkers. There you go. There you go. I never said math was my strong. All right. Okay, so if we take the people in this room, but you are all so enlightened and you already know that we need to do education different. So you're not representative of the greater masses, I will tell you that. But all right, so we have critical thinkers, or critical thinking, most important. Self-actualization, I love that. Balanced. We need to be balanced human beings, really. You know, our life on this planet is pretty short. It shouldn't be all about working, right, to get things, to consume things. And let's see, then we have some workforce readiness, some basic literacy. Nobody thought informed voting, interesting. Okay, moral values, health and longevity. Very interesting, but now, we're not going to do this question again to ask you the way you would answer if you were in elementary school, but you know that would look completely different, wouldn't it? If you were answering it, or high school, or if you were in the Sudan and you didn't have any food and people, you know, were dying from disease, the answer would be quite different. So part of the discussion is if we could all agree on the purpose of education, it would be a lot easier to reconstruct what education should be. But I can tell you that we can't. I mean, this is going to be all over the board. So before I turn this over to Ismo, who's going to talk about financial literacy, I want to make sure that you do pick up a postcard that's in the back that has our website, globalschoolnet.org, and my business card is back there too, in case you have any questions that come up related to things that I told you about. So we're going to pass it on.
So I'm the National Director for Financial Education and Employer Services for TE Wealth. We're based out of Toronto. We are the largest fee-only financial planning firm in Canada. Fee-only means we don't sell any products. We just work on a fee-for-service basis. So we work, we provide financial education programs for government, nonprofits, certainly the private sector, and for First Nations. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge that we are today on the traditional territory of the First Nations here in British Columbia of the Lillooet, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. And so I just want to acknowledge our presence on their traditional territory. That's kind of the world that I live in, that clients ask me to consult on. Can you help, Ismo? Can you help us unravel that bundle of issues that our employees are dealing with? Because they're concerned about education. They're concerned about managing their wealth. They don't understand their pensions and benefits. We've got people who are all over the map in terms of their functional literacy and especially their financial literacy. We're paying them pretty good dollars. We have a business plan that's supported by human resources strategy, which is the attraction and retention of people,
in order to do that competitively, we have to pay them a total compensation picture. There's direct compensation and there's indirect compensation, salary and benefits. A lot of people get it, but a lot of people don't. We're in tough times right now, so we want to do something to help them maximize the use of what we do pay them. And if you think about the bigger picture, if everybody was better at managing their personal finances, maybe our society would improve as well. So what I'm going to talk to you about here is a little bit about financial literacy, nothing new here. I don't think I'm going to say anything that's brand new to any of you here. But there is a structure and there's some key messages here that ties into the things that we've been learning about over the last day or so here. We'll talk about the rewards and consequences of being financially literate or not. Where do we have areas of control? What do we do with that control in terms of our financial behavior modification? What are other people doing in terms of best practices? And what can we do individually and collectively to make a difference and close those gaps? So here's a question for you. For those of you, if you clicked on the first question, pass your clicker to somebody else. So in the year 1670, a Hudson's Bay company, first company in Canada, executive, invested $1 in a trust fund at 5% simple interest. How much is in the fund today? Less than $100, about $1,000, at least $100,000, more than $1 million. So go ahead and vote, 1, 2, 3, or 4. Don't blurt out the answer if you think you know it. Okay, stay silent here, no cheating.
Is that 5% per year?
Yes, that's annual simple interest. Okay. Somebody's doing the math on their calculators, that's cheating. Come on, okay. I think we're going to stop there, okay? Stop clicking. Okay, there's 27. We'll stop there. 27. Okay, we'll do the polling here. This is a tough crowd. Very good. Except you didn't use simple interest, you used compound interest. The answer D would be correct if it was 6 over 4 would be correct because the answer is 16.8 million if it was 5% compound interest. The answer is number 1. It's $18.05. Simple interest is a dollar that earns 5 cents this year. Next year it's the same dollar that earns another nickel. So we got 341 nickels plus the original dollar. So compound interest is interest on interest. That's why you would have 16.8 million if it was compound interest. So here's a very, very basic financial literacy issue. How many times do we come across issues with compound interest? We're trying to save money. We're trying to make money. This is kind of basic, folks. So financial literacy, it's no longer the three R's. It's functioning in daily life. The ability, under the IELTS study in 1995, International Adult Literacy Survey, and in the subsequent surveys, that literacy is now defined as domains of behavior. Your ability to extract financial information from prose documents like charts and graphs and from quantitative information and connect the dots. And we need that in daily life. If you're diabetic, you need to know how many carbs you're taking in every day and how many calories. If you have high blood pressure, what's the sodium content in that can of Campbell's soup? Do you know how to read your pension statement? Just a little question here. How many of you are employed in a company that provides some type of employer-sponsored retirement program? About half, maybe not even, 35-40%. And that's standard. Okay? So how many of you can actually, the rhetorical question here, when you get your annual or quarterly pension statement, you actually know what they're talking about? Okay? Good.
So what we want to do here, if it's functioning in daily life, how do people make their plans? Well, it's based on what's happened in the past, and it looks at where you are today, and based on that, you start making projections. But what if your current starting point is wrong? What if you're not accurate? Your projections are wrong by definition. So now we're talking about the future. So everybody's thinking about hoping that things will work. But if you're talking about individuals, you're talking about family finances, you're talking about the implications of careers, you're talking about society, and as the gentleman this morning mentioned about what's happening in the newspapers, and the U.S. government has to come up by August 4th to pay off some debt here, that kind of thing. So we've got financially illiterate people in Washington, it seems. All these kinds of issues, it affects all of us. So now we're looking at what's achievable individually and collectively in terms of personal finances and company finances and society's finances. But what are some of the things that we want to prevent? Because you don't want to find a solution that becomes your next problem. So here's another question for you. Pass your clicker to someone else. So what's your primary source for personal financial information? General public information, the general media, newspapers, magazines, or do you actually use specific financial news sources, radio, TV, online? Maybe you just talk with family and friends. Maybe you have professional advisors. What's your primary source? Just press 1, 2, or 3, or 4, whatever you think is your appropriate answer. We're good? Is that about it? Okay, we'll stop there. We'll let it poll here. And there's other sources too, but these are the big categories. Okay, many of you have professional advisors. Now we're talking to some of the things that Yvonne had mentioned and some of the other speakers have talked about is the wisdom of crowds and collaborating. And I think it was in Vaughn's slide that said, picking the right crowd. So if you're reading the general newspapers, how accurate are those reports? Is there a bias? If you're getting information from a particular investment management firm, how biased are they? How knowledgeable are your family and friends? And your professional advisor, is there a conflict of interest? So many years ago, I wrote a paper on financial education, financial planning, that people can either abdicate their responsibility. You know what? I'm so lost on this. You're a good guy. You take care of it. Or, you know what? I don't know anything about this, so I'll just have my spouse deal with it, abdicating the responsibility. Then there's those of you out in the audience who might be very adept, very interested, very knowledgeable. You have discount brokers, you've got professional advisors, you do your own analysis, you're pretty much up to speed on your average tax bracket, your marginal tax bracket. You know how different investment works in terms of exchange-traded funds and target date funds. Very knowledgeable. But then there's the delegate. I know what I want to do with my life, but I don't know all that stuff, so I have to delegate the analytical task to someone, so that they can come back to me and narrow the universe and make some palatable options for me so that I can make a cognizant business decision about how to manage my finances and how to connect those dots. Questions like, should I put money into my group RSP here in Canada or into my 401k or IRA down in the States, or should I pay off my mortgage? Well, it depends on where you are in your career. It depends on your mortgage rate, when you're going to pay that off. What is your target retirement date? How do you feel about investments? What's your marginal tax bracket, your average tax bracket? How much of a surplus cash flow do you have every month to do this? But now we can go to the wisdom of crowds, okay? Because when I started in the business in the late 70s, early 80s, I remember doing an equitable distribution case in Rochester, New York. I was actually born in Finland, but I grew up in Rochester, and I started financial services there. And I remember working with the lawyer and the accountant, and the accountant was using a slide rule. This is in 1981 to do the mathematical calculations. Okay, I remember doing retirement projections where we were using age 80. for retirement projections. Now we're using age 90 on second to die. There's over 80,000 people in the U.S. over the age of 100, close to 6,000 here in Canada. How is that going to affect pension plans when people are living a little bit longer? In the U.K., they're putting in liability insurance to ensure that extra year or two or three that pensions have to pay out another $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year per retiree. So now we start looking at the wisdom of crowds, and I have to tell you that it's critically important to find that right crowd. There's a lot of biases out there that you have to discern where's the credible information coming from. Pass your clicker to someone else. Just see how we're doing here. So when you have your four, don't vote yet. You have four pieces to your financial statements. You've got your net worth statement, which is a snapshot in time of the current value of your assets, what you own, minus liabilities, what you owe. The answer, hopefully, is positive. You have a positive net worth. Okay? The motion picture is the cash flow coming in, income, and the expenses going out. And if you have more money coming in every month than when went out, including after tax, that's surplus. A business would call that a profit. So after-tax cash flow, that profit would then be applied to your net worth, which means that you pay off your debts and or build up your financial assets. That's how you build net worth. So do you know right now what your current net worth is within a reasonable number? And if you know that, have you also figured out how much you might need at target your target retirement date? And for those of you who have already retired, have you figured out, do you have enough to live on an after-tax and inflation-adjusted basis? Very simple question, yes or no. Okay, go ahead and vote. Okay, we'll let it calculate. We use this technology in the seminars because people don't want to raise their hand in front of their friends. Okay, so here's the thing. If you could tell me the day you're going to die, I could work out your financial plan pretty well. But since we don't know that, it becomes an ongoing iterative process to continually set targets and do reassessments. And this requires financial literacy. This requires the ability to use tools. So people need to be aware of an issue. For example, I do for a number of clients, understanding your benefits, new hires. They need to be aware of their benefits. They need to understand how they work. We need to get them emotionally engaged and interested. Oh, these are my numbers. This is going to make a difference for me. But now I'm looking at all this and I get scared. My anxiety has now gone up because I don't have the skills. I don't have the tools. And I might even need a little bit of a spark of a motivation to actively manage my financial future. Because when I check the box to do this, that, or the other thing, I need to be comfortable doing that. And I'm not. And so that adult learning process becomes very, very important. And nobody else will do this for you because it's your plan and it's your life. Now, you can get outside help, as 57% of you do get outside help, to help you manage all that. Okay? So what are the best practices for collaboration? I didn't put tools in here necessarily, but you talk to family and friends, your peer group. You've got pretty smart people in the cubicle, you know, next to you and down the hall. All kinds of media, including social media. But again, be careful. I mean, if I look at some of the Twitter accounts out there in the financial services, I'd say, where the heck is this stuff coming from? This isn't accurate. They're missing the boat here. Whereas some of the other information is pretty reasonable. Your employers. In the U.S., you've got something called a safe harbor under the Department of Labor, where if a plan sponsor employer provides all this information and follows the checklist in terms of retirement programs under ERISA, there's no problem. If an employee sues and says, I didn't get enough information, I'm floundering here in retirement, the lawyers are going to say, tough, these are all the things they did, they're covered. Here in Canada, we can do all those things and more, and there isn't any protection. So employers have to work together, which means now they go to associations. And this is a real problem. I've been in the business since, again, the late 70s, early 80s, and I'm reading articles in the paper today about pension legislation that I think if we just put the changed it to 1991, it wouldn't make a difference. because the same issues are out there. It isn't the question of new tools coming out. New tools aren't going to do anything to help people if their behavior doesn't change, if they don't adapt new behaviors. So, and the advisors, when I took my first certified financial planner exam in 1983 in the U.S., there were six of us taking the exam in Monroe County. When I, 2 years later, there must have been 300 people taking one of the six exams in the St. John's University auditorium. This business is going like crazy, so what criteria are you going to use to select a financial advisor? Because I'll tell you right now, the bar of entry is not very high to get into this business. So there's a functional literacy issue here. Do you know what questions to ask your financial advisor? Right? So one more question. Pass your clicker to someone else. And the question is obviously, how confident are you about managing your financial future? Okay. Now, as you can see, it varies. Now the question becomes, you're now aware and hopefully you understand a little bit of the issues. Hopefully you are emotionally engaged and interested in doing something about it, but now your anxiety goes up because you don't have the necessary skills. You don't know what tools to use. And you might need an extra spark of motivation. So where's that going to come from? So that when you do change your behavior, you know what you're doing. The problem I see out there, though, is that people don't know what their current behavior is. Because you can't change your behavior unless you know what it is. If we're talking about money, money has no intrinsic value. We only exchange it for goods and services. So when someone sends me their financial statement, what's going through the checkbook is basically their value system. Because people don't throw money away. They exchange it for goods and services. So we're trying to solve for that bottom line. So you have to go back through the checkbook and say that, why is that important to me? Is that a nice to have or a must have? And then you have that communication over the kitchen table where one spouse is a saver, the other is a spender. Okay? And then you're trying to teach kids, you know, those 80 million young people out there spending gazillion dollars that we just heard under the echo boomers. What are the parents telling those kids about the exchange of money and the value systems? Isn't education generally from all sources important here? So let me just close. So if you wanted to cross that ravine, just walk down that ravine and I'm not prepared to walk down that ravine and there's rapids and snakes and stuff. I need to build a bridge. So I need to assess where am I today and what do I need to do to get to the other side. I need to be realistic about my objectives, what's really doable. There are some truthful challenges. Man, I might have to do this as opposed to that. I might have to do some sacrifices in my behavior. I'm uncomfortable talking to my spouse about the state of our finances or to talking to my kids that maybe they can't go to the $27,000 a year tuition school. They might have to go to a $8,000 state school because their friends are going there and they're not. All geared to peace of mind. Okay? I mean, if we're always dealing with our health issues, relationship issues, our career issues, our financial issues, it's all dealing with reducing volatility and having peace of mind. So what's the preferable future for financial literacy? Well, one, it's life skill development, continual learning. It's a shared responsibility. Banks, financial institutions, government, nonprofit, private sector firms, everybody has to be involved. It has to be transparent and accountable. Somebody has to measure this, and maybe the school boards need to put something in there in terms of assessing financial literacy. I mean, I remember when I went to high school, you had to pass a swim test to graduate from high school. Maybe we need to pass some sort of financial literacy test as well. And also, there needs to be transparency because there's conflicts of interest. The banks want relationships. They want to loan you as much money as you can possibly handle. And if you still got money, they want to invest it for you. There's a conflict of interest. So this continual collaborative learning is what it's all about. And for a successful future, I really like this guy's comment. It said that if you want to know what you were doing in the past, look at your body now. If you want to know what will happen to you in the future, look at what your mind is doing now. I just want to thank the World Future Society for having us here, myself, Yvonne, and your group at Global School Net for giving me a call last year to come up here. Pauline and Rick and Tammy, thanks for participating in our group. And I'd like to thank all of you out there for coming today, and hopefully you found this useful, and have a successful financial future. Thanks very much.